Welcome to the Quality Time Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Woodworth. And boy, oh boy, we got a special guest this week. No Jeremy Woodworth, but filling in the very big shoes that he leaves behind, filled with psoriasis skin flakes, is none other than comedian extraordinaire Mr. Mike Moran of the Confessional Podcast. He joins the Quality Time hosts, myself and Miss Ashley Pontius, on this wonderful excursion into the world of Halloween Part 4 and 5. But hey, guys, if you love the show, I can't ask it enough. If you go out there, tell a friend about us. We're just a small-time operation. And if you want to go above and beyond, you know what? Leave us a five-star rating on the Apple Podcasts, the Stitcher, the Podbean, whatever platform you listen to us on. It costs you nothing at all and means the absolute world to us. So without further ado, get strapped in, crank that volume up to 11, and get ready for Halloween Part 4 and 5.
Kiddies, it's your old pal, the Crypt Keeper. This is a big shout out to my friends at Quality Time Podcast.
I love a guy, like, I want to go to an alt comedy show and just, like, all MAGA hats, and then, like, slowly realize, like, wait a minute, is this not what I thought it was? Like a whole crowd of them.
Yeah, there is a weird usage of the word alt, you know? It seems like a very left-leaning word to me, generally. You know what I mean? Like, I think alternative rock, alternative lifestyle, alternative culture. I don't picture MAGA hats.
The best part is, like, halfway, the guy sits there for a good 45 to 50 minutes. He's like, hey, when are we going to start talking about Donald Trump? Like he doesn't pick it up in the first, like, 5 minutes. He sits.
Right.
He's a good audience member up until that, and it finally reaches a boiling point in him. That's my new character.
And he's, like, thinking, like, is this, like, satirical? Are they, like, are we making fun of those people?
Wait a minute. Is this, like, you guys are making fun of Trevor Noah the whole time, right? That's what I actually came here for. That's a good bit right there. I got to be honest with you, Mike. I have been so nuts deep in the Halloween game this month. It is.
There's a Halloween game?
No, like in the podcasting research game of Halloween stuff. My brain is just filled with needless knowledge that I can't use anything with except for this podcast.
You know, maybe you go into a job interview, you list your skills, you drop a few Halloween 5 facts, you know, he might be impressed.
Dude, maybe that works out, because that would fucking rock.
Yay. Hey, Ashley.
Hi, Mike. So sorry to hold you up.
That's all right. No one's waiting for me.
How frustrated are you on a scale of 1 to 10? Are you ready?
Almost cried.
Yeah. Are we ready to get kicked off? Welcome to Quality Time, the podcast with all the things you need to know this month about the movie Halloween. I said, I name is Eric Woodworth, and I'm not going to change that. I'm going to live with those little floils and blubs that I mess up all the time because I'm a big mush mouth dummy head. But I'm no Jeremy Woodworth this week. My brother is not in studio, but I am joined by the very lovely, the very talented Miss Ashley Pontius. Ashley, how are you, love?
Hi, Daddy. I'm functioning.
I like it. You've poured yourself a glass of wine. Your rig isn't working. There's a lot of you're carrying in a lot of stuff into this show. Are you going to be okay?
I'm gonna be fine. I'm gonna go eat my feelings after the podcast. I'm still trying to recover from the fact that I saw Eric Jacquelaire in a thong last night. So,
I saw some pictures of that, and it
was horrible.
You know, and his fully engorged fucking man sleeve that he's made for himself. He's a restoration foreskin guy. Did you know that?
It was pretty great. Tommy brought it up on stage, and it really made my night. It was camo pattern, and I was like, "Oh, look, you got a camo toe."
Oh, God bless him. God bless him for that. Also, we're joined by a very special guest this week, filling in the very easy shoes of Jeremy Woodworth, the super talented host of the Confessional Podcast, as well as tons of other projects and stuff. Artist extraordinaire, comedian extraordinaire, Mr. Mike Moran. Mike, how are you, sir?
Hi, Daddy.
Oh, Mike, it's good to have you on. I think the last time you were on was the last Halloween, where we went over all the continuity of the Halloween timelines.
Yes, yes. Many, many different continuities, and I hope we help some people figure those out. Thanks for having me. Great to see you, Eric. Great to see you, Ashley.
I love Mike. Mike is, I think Mike is one of, in my group of, like, comedians that all started around the same time. You're in my class, right? Like, we're all...
I think so.
Started around like the 2010s, somewhere around there. So you were like you're my batch of guys, right? So I dig
absolutely.
It. I've seen Mike for years at open mics, and we have bombed in some of the finest bars and restaurants in the state of Maryland. You have
we
no
really
clue.
Have.
We've really bonded over the years. But that's good, man. And tell the folks and listeners of Quality Time a little bit about the Confessional Podcast before we hop into tonight.
Well, it is a podcast in which we interview people on a different subject every week, usually something a little different, a little darker, of the darker variety, of which I'm sure the listeners of this are familiar with. You know, spooky, scary story type stuff, or very deep, personal, inappropriate information type stuff, or personal struggles, or we talk hard. We actually read listener submissions throughout. There's a little bit of that going on, and we've had some special guests lately. We've had Michael Ian Black in the last couple months. We have had Matt Pinfield of MTV fame.
Oh wow!
We've had Joanna Angel. We have had two Ramones, two out of three of the surviving Ramones.
Oh, wow.
Two different episodes.
What was, is it weird? I'm sorry, you were breaking up just a little bit there, so I cut you off. But out of all those names, I know you met Ramones and stuff like that, but you want to know, I dropped right dead in my tracks because you said you interviewed Matt Pinfield. I mean, he must be a fascinating person to talk to.
Oh yeah, he's great. He was he was a super nice guy. Really interesting. Definitely a talker. He didn't let us down for sure.
Now, out of all your guests you've had in recent weeks, we have a shared guest between both of our podcasts, and that's the great Michael Winslow. And
yes.
I'm not going to say you listened to our episode because I'm sure you didn't. Okay, but how did was your experience with Michael Winslow anything like ours? Because what I got away with is that we had a plan for the show, and what it ended up being was Michael Winslow being physically incapable of not
right,
making
right.
sound effects. Like he was.
Let me put it to you this way. You know how like sometimes someone like that, you have them on and you're worried they're going to be like, oh, I don't want to do my signature thing that everybody always asks me to do that I did in the 80s. That was not him. That man.
Yes.
He lives and breathes his sound. He lives in his own sound effects world.
Yeah, I will admit, though, because if I had a choice between one or the other, right? Because there's nothing more that I hate, and I hearken back to, you're familiar with the band Silverchair, right? And trust me, there's a point to all this, but Silverchair. So Silverchair, who essentially in the U.S. is a one-hit wonder, right? They had that song. What is it? Wait Till Tomorrow. I'm not. Wait till tomorrow.
I wouldn't call them a one-hit wonder, Eric, in the U.S. I think they had multiple hits, but.
I don't believe that to be true, though Tommy has also argued with me against that. But, inarguably, their biggest hit is Wait Till Tomorrow, at least stateside. No?
Sure.
Okay, right. So sure.
I'll take that.
They came to Baltimore, and they played. And you know what? They did a 90-minute set. You know what song they didn't play? They didn't play that fucking song. And people were fucking pissed. I mean, this is you got to play the hits. I don't like it. I mean, I get it. Like, you get tired of it. You know, there's famous there's famous bands like who's the song that does the guys who wrote Cherry Pie? Who fucking
Warrant
hates the song Cherry Pie, but you know what they do when they get a show? They play the fucking song.
I saw them a couple years ago at the M3 Festival, and they closed it out with that.
Yes, they're gonna play their fucking hit because that's what you paid your ticket to go see, right? I came to experience that nostalgia,
absolutely,
the thing that kept your lights on for years. But Silverchair was like, nah, miss me with our hits, bro.
Right.
I can't even do it. So,
right,
but
right.
That Michael Winslow.
Yeah, I hate that stuff.
Michael Winslow.
The Ramones are always good about doing that.
Yeah, well, the Ramones also have like multiple hits, and I feel like, you know, they're in the same kind of vein as an AC/DC, where it's like, yeah, this is the type of music we do, and we're going to do the exact same music over and over again. You're going to love it, and I don't give a shit what the fuck you think. This is our job, right? So
yeah.
I like when people do their jobs. I don't like when they get over.
Absolutely.
You got to be a special kind of talent to not do that, right? Like, I wouldn't be mad. Let's say the late great Freddie Mercury, if he was alive, and I went to a Freddie Mercury show, and he was like, you know what, I'm not doing Bohemian Rhapsody. I'd be fine. I'd be fine with that because he's so talented. I'd be like, this is still really, really special. But like, come on, give me fucking. If you're Warrant, you're playing fucking Cherry Pie, though.
Well, I think of the same thing with like Dan Crabb. Like, could you imagine going to a show with Dan Crabb and you're like, dude, Dave's wood chips, and he's like, no, I ain't doing it.
That's, you know what, when I think when I mentioned Freddie Mercury, the next person was Daniel Crabb, local comedian with the wood chips.
Or when Eric was performing and they're like, play the song about the inflatable girlfriend.
Yes, exactly. It's funny.
Like, I'm an artist, I don't just do that.
It's funny. Yeah, I started. I feel like I've become a pretty decent actual stand-up comedian, but I did start just doing purely musical comedy back in 2010. But it's funny, the people who I kind of started out with, of course, like Mike and Ryan Nazer, it comes to mind. Ryan Nazer books me on shows at the Cellar Door, and he demands that I play this song that does not hold up in the 2020s, right? Like, I have a song called My Brother, which is, it's called My Brother, but it's really My Brother the Abortion, which is a horrible song. It's one of the first ones I ever wrote, but he thinks it's the funniest thing. He requests it, and it doesn't go over good in 2020. It's just, we're in a different time now, and I've slowly erased it from my repertoire, but when I see him, he demands that it be played, and that I experience the pain of me writing this once again.
Which is so weird to me that it didn't age well, because I feel like 2020 is the year of the abortion. Like, the Chinese calendar is like year of the dog, year of the goat. I'm like, this is the year of the abortion.
Oh, Ash, you're back in full form. Thank God. All right, so you folks ready to get into tonight's topic? We've got a lot to go over. We've done 10 minutes of banter to start off with. Oh, man. 1988. Well, we're going to go over Halloween, both 4 and 5, which I'm excited about because I got to be honest with you. This is a story of both night and day. There is good in I'm going to say I like a Halloween 4. Man, but Halloween 5 is just the flaming... I'll say it right now. Apart from Resurrection, this is the worst Halloween film. I'll say Halloween 5. It's the second worst one in the series. Does anybody...
I'm already disagreeing a little bit.
You're already disintegrating a little bit?
Disagreeing. My voice is...
Oh, okay.
Disintegrating, but...
So you put Halloween 5 up on a higher mantle.
Though it still may be my second worst, like you, next to Resurrection, I don't really think it's all that worse than Part 4.
We'll get into that. Let me break down... As we break down Part 4 and hop into Part 5, I always thought Part 4 and 5 were just kind of one movie in my head, because I'd seen them growing up.
Like 1 and 2.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, kind of like 1 and 2. But there is... I mean, now that I've been watching it more critically, Part 5 is fucking bad compared to 4. Part 5 is fucking really bad. But let's get into just how Halloween 4 kind of came to birth. Now, we are coming off of Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, which is, for the most part, a commercial flop. That's where they went away from Michael Myers being the main character. Which, by the way, Season of the Witch, definitely an underappreciated movie that certainly found its crowd now, as horror fans have aged and really looked at the whole series, and you're like, you know what? Season of a Witch is a good movie. It is a good movie. I actually like it. If it had just been called Season of the Witch, you can go back in our archives to experience Halloween 3, which we did last year. It's a great film. Now we're at 1988, though, which brings forth a slew of sequels in 1988. I mean, in this year, you get Return of the Living Dead Part 2, Friday the 13th Part 7, Sleepaway Camp 2, Hellraiser 2, Poltergeist 3, Phantasm 2, Nightmare on Elm Street Part 4, not to mention Critters 2 and The Howling 4. So it is just the height of horror sequels in 1988, right?
Yeah.
I got to be honest with you, quality isn't always at the forefront. I mean, when you think about just Friday the 13th, which really is like its biggest, you know, from a commercial standpoint, it is the biggest competitor with Halloween. Friday the 13th came out in 1980, and it's only 8 years since that original movie, and they're on their 7th installment already of the franchise in just
that
a short...
Crazy.
I mean, it is crazy. They are churning these things out year after year after year. Now... And with the willingness of the 80s crowd for horror to just go see these subpar sequels, because, I mean, you and I both know, I think we're all kind of in agreement, I can know a sequel is bad. It's dog shit. It's going to be the worst movie in the whole world. I will still sit down and watch it and find things that I love about
many
it.
Many times, man. I mean, I've seen the worst Halloween movies at least 10 times a piece, probably.
Yes, and then you pick them apart so we could do podcasts.
Yeah, it becomes more of like a thing where I'm fascinated with the whole format and you know, the behind the scenes, and I don't know, there's just something where I just... The franchise itself becomes fascinating no matter how bad it is.
And I think that is a quality that is unique to the horror fan, right? Like, there's no other fandom that will know something is bad and still watch it, right? Like Star Trek, and like, look at Star Wars, right? One of the biggest sci-fi movie franchises in the world. Man, they're fucking fans. When they hate Star Wars, they show it at the box office now. And I mean, that showed with like the most recent trilogy, right? Like, they're like, we've had enough. You're not going to do this to us anymore. And I'm at the same part where I'm like, yeah, I could watch Sleepaway Camp 3 tonight. Like, I just get in a mood. I'm like, I could watch this bullshit right now.
Well, you know what else is interesting too, I find in particular about my relationship to horror movies, and I won't speak for everyone, but I think maybe it's kind of a universal theme with the fan, is that this is also one of the few genres that you can kind of see the growth in your relationship to these films, because a lot of us get started on this stuff not as an adult. You get started on these types of films in, you know, very late elementary school, you know, early middle school, and you're kind of hitting puberty. And it's weird to kind of watch the transition to these movies as you first experience them in childhood, and then your relationship to them as an adult and onward. So it's interesting the way you can grow with these films in different ways that you can't always with other genres.
Yeah, and I think that has a lot to do with just the nature of horror in general. It's, you know, Joe Bob Briggs, whether you love him or hate him, I think really explains kind of the horror genre well. He never calls them horror movies. He calls them exploitation films. And that's really what they are. They exploit something about us to get a dollar out of us. Unlike other movies like, you know, dramas or something like that, where they try to bring you in by just the story. This, he says that horror movies kind of share the same kind of world as like blaxploitation films do. They literally expound upon somebody's desire to see this type of media, and they know whether it's good or bad, you'll still turn up and watch it no matter what. So it's a surefire bet for the most part. And it's true. When horror's done great, we love it to death. And when it's done bad, we still kind of fucking love it. I mean, there's... So
you are not wrong. I tried... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mike.
No, nothing.
So I was just going to say the other night I tried to watch Bones starring Snoop Dogg from, I want to say, the early 2000s.
Yeah.
What a nightmare, but I couldn't turn it off.
Well, let's hear a little bit about Mustafa Akkad, who is kind of in the driver's seat of the franchise from this point on.
It was into this climate then that Akkad's company, Trankus International, released Halloween 4, The Return of Michael Myers.
I just went back to the basics of Halloween 1 on Halloween 4. And it was the most successful.
Initially, John Carpenter and Deborah Hill championed a script by Dennis Etchison, who under the name Jack Martin had previously penned the novelizations of Halloween's 2 and 3. It was at this point that the legal battles began. At stake was the ownership and direction of the series.
The legal specifics I'm not sure of. I know Carpenter pretty much divorced himself from the whole Halloween idea and the studio for a number of years.
I received a call from Deborah Hill. And she said, Dennis, I just wanted you to know that John and I have sold our interest in the title Halloween, and unfortunately your script was not part of the deal.
Mustafa Akkad gained ownership of the series with the intention of producing something more traditional. There was no doubt in the minds of fans as to who the star of their beloved films was.
So... obviously, the legal battle insists between Carpenter and Deborah Hill, who had produced and directed Halloween 1 and, you know, and Halloween 2, kind of wrote that. But now we're at Halloween 4, since 3 was a flop. Carpenter's idea was always to make this kind of an anthology series. And John Carpenter, in just general, he's always been a guy who doesn't like to play well with the studio. He's like, I want to make my movie, and if I can't make my movie, then that's fine. I'll figure out another way. So he sells off his rights to Halloween. But it was really interesting, the story that they had talked about. The original plot line for Halloween 4 was actually supposed to be Haddonfield Haddonfield in 1988, 10 years after the original murders had occurred. Except now Halloween is banned in Haddonfield, and it plays on the idea that if you ban something and you make it and you try to suppress something, that it just comes back stronger in that way. So I thought it was a really cool idea, but unfortunately when Carpenter pulled out, he also pulled out the story idea that was written for it. So we got stuck with basically Halloween 4 being a retelling almost and a rebirth of the Michael Myers character. And the storyline, for the most part, kind of follows the original idea of just like, yep, this is Michael Myers. You know he wants to kill his family because you watch Halloween 2. And guess what? He is a new family member in this. Now, for this time, you have to also keep in mind that they are competing with the juggernaut that is Friday the 13th, right? They kind of mirror each other. Friday the 13th came 2 years after the original Halloween, but there is this idea of very similar characters, a juggernaut that runs through camp counselors and teenagers, you know, very much the same way Michael Myers is a semi-juggernaut and invincible character that can run through suburbia. So, but the difference between between the two is that since then, since the original Halloween, which wasn't an original gore fest or anything like that, you're now competing with Tom Savini, a special effects wizard who really, I feel, revolutionized gore in general and horror. He, you have to kind of compete with that kind of bloodthirsty bloodthirsty audience that's been created with this type of monster. Because originally, you know, Halloween 1 and 2, you're just still dealing with a guy that can get shot a couple of times. And in this one, Michael Myers is fucking lifting people off their legs with one hand like he's the fucking Undertaker and shoving shotguns through their torso.
Well, and the idea that not only do you want more blood and, you know, this bloodthirsty audience, you're 100% right, but also the idea now behind original kills, something unique that you've never seen before that's going to get people to even clap or cheer, that they've never seen a kill quite like what they can offer. I mean, I know it's not a horror movie, but I love the John Wick movies. And
yeah, for
I
the
love-
same reason, because I want to know what kind of, I want to see him do gun karate, right? Like, I want
to. But I mean, like John Wick 3, I remember like watching a way someone got killed in like a super unique way, the way he got stabbed or something. And you're like, I find myself cheering because it's like, I've never thought about someone getting killed that way. I never had imagined something like that. Or even watching The Walking Dead. It's like every week you almost tune in to see a new horrific way you've never come up with for someone to die.
Absolutely. I have a little audio clip here now. Keeping that in mind that you're competing with the Friday the 13th series, which is, again, it's coming out with its seventh installment in this same year. Here is John Carl Bouchler. He's the special effects gentleman from Halloween 4, talking about Akkad kind of wanting to keep it not so bloody and to the original, but at the same time wanting to make money. Here we go.
I know that when we pulled apart Earl's neck, Mustafa, who was a stickler for, we don't want too much blood. This is not a Friday the 13th movie. This is a Halloween movie. I understand that when we were doing Earl, he kept saying, more blood, more blood.
Everyone keeps on thinking.
So I do find that very hilarious. I kind of, Mustafa Akkad, the more I learn about him, is just such the perennial horror businessman. He was just like, we make it like the old movie, we stay true to it. No, we need more fucking blood now. Do you understand? We make blood for this scene. So I really do enjoy his Mustafa, who kept the series alive until he was actually murdered in a terrorist attack in 2005.
He was bombed. Yeah,
what?
Very sad. Yeah, there was a famous bombing overseas in a hotel, and he died in it. I think his child as well.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's crazy. So so this one, the other thing you run into with problems with 4, the budget isn't quite there because they kind of had a flop with 3, is that you can't get Jamie Lee Curtis. She's a huge star right this time.
Right.
So Jamie Lee is written off much in the same way as they would write off any character in a soap opera, dies in a car accident that you don't get to see in the movie, and we are presented with Jamie, her child, who's played by Danielle Harris. So, so Danielle Harris joins it as a child, and I have a little audio from Danielle Harris here. You'll hear her both as a child at the beginning of this clip and later as an adult in the early 2000s.
The killer's new target.
In Halloween 4, she's younger and she doesn't know very much about this guy, her uncle, and she's just mainly running from him and trying to get away from this killer.
I was banging on doors for someone to help me after I got lost trick-or-treating or something. So 4 o'clock in the morning, they're hearing a little girl screaming through the streets and somebody called the cops. The cops came, and then the story ended up in the Inquirer that I was almost kidnapped off of the set.
Which I think is pretty, that's a fun story. You're filming out.
I never heard that one.
You're filming out there and Danielle Harris gets the cops called on her. You're also, they add in other elements in this one. We get Ellie Cornell, who plays Rachel, which is basically, which is Jamie's stepsister in the film. Here's a little bit of Ellie Cornell.
I remember when Halloween 4 came out, I was in line to read for the lead, I think in Nightmare on Elm Street. And I was glad I got this one, truly. It's been, yeah, it was great. For Danielle Harris and I, that film was a boot camp in many ways, because I think the total shoot was maybe 41 or 42 days, and we might have worked 38 of them. So it was a long, arduous project.
So the cast is rounded out by Sasha Jensen, who plays the boyfriend Brady, and Kathleen Kinmont, who plays Kelly, who's got big old milk cannons in this movie.
I literally made a note. I was like, big giant boobs.
Yeah, and they add in between those three, Rachel, Brady, and Kelly. There's a love triangle subplot that kind of flows through the movie. Which it's very funny. Sasha Jensen, the actor who plays Brady in the film, he was kind of sketch in what he did during the filming of this. Put it like this. I'm going to play this audio clip, and I feel like today he gets canceled for what he was trying to do behind scenes. So let's hear a little bit of the backstory to these three actors and actresses.
So when Sasha and I, when the day came for us to do
this is Kathleen Kinmont, who plays Kelly right here.
Makeout scene in front of the fireplace. A couple nights before, Sasha goes, "Well, you know, we need to rehearse." And I'm like, "Oh, okay. So what do you want to do?"
See, Kathleen was a wonderful flirt, and the boys all loved her. She was very good on set and very bad off set.
Dwight Little made us go behind the...
And this is Ellie Cornell talking about Sasha as well.
Trailer and practice. And I was like, practice what? He just said, he just wanted it to look like, you know, we had smooched before. It's not an easy feat, folks. I don't care how cute he is. It's hard. It's hard to get in front of the whole, you know.
Actually, Sasha did admit that yesterday.
What did he say?
No, that it took some doing, that he was actually the provoker.
That he was really acting?
Yes.
Get his ass down here. I want to talk to him.
So old Sasha Jensen was walking around telling actors, wow, like, you know, we got to practice kissing before we go out there. Not let's run lines. Let's right, just become a Me Too hashtag tonight.
Yeah, and it turns out he actually said it to Dr. Loomis as well.
He's just like, you know, Donald, we have this kiss scene. I did not read that in the script, but I'm such a good actor. Let's do it. He was game to go along with it.
I'm not against it, though, because, I mean, I problematic female. My thing is, I kind of understand, because when I used to do some acting when I was younger, every now and again, if there's a kiss scene, there is something embarrassing that if you're like, you're not ready, or if you're not quite like on point when it happens, there's something kind of embarrassing if you have no chemistry with someone where it clearly looks like you guys don't know what you're doing.
Okay, good. So now, I don't know, there was some joke in there, but it bombed. It was going to just sound like me trying to make out with Ashley. And I, you know what? I'm beyond that now. I'm beyond that.
Oh my God. No, you're not.
You're beyond making out with Ashley.
So, the cast is rounded out by the old timer, Donald Pleasance, who's, making his, third appearance in the Halloween franchise, returning as Dr. Loomis, which this is the hardest thing to remember, because if we're leaving from number two,
this is the elephant in the room. This is an unforgivable retcon.
He's if you watch the end of Halloween 2, last week's episode, he exploded himself with oxygen and nitrogen, and the movie ends with the mask burning up and everything, and Donald,
Michael Myers is like a skeleton at the end of the second one.
Yes,
exactly.
Yes, he's Daniel Stern getting electrocuted in fucking Home Alone.
And they pass it off as they almost died in a fire. fire. Moving on.
Yeah, yeah. He looks like Don, and all they do is give him makeup that makes him look like a slightly overcooked chicken McNugget. That's it. It's just right. Like, oh, I got a little bit burned in there. In that room I clearly escaped from because I have
acne scars from adolescence that are worse.
Yes. Yeah. I blew myself up so I looked like the pop star Seal. That's the worst thing that happened to him.
right. Look, I'm not necessarily in favor of making this a supernatural series because that's just not in its nature. But if you're bringing back Michael in this one, you have to make it supernatural. There's no way that body survived the end of part two.
Right. I agree. Now, at least Friday the 13th dealt with that, right? They were like, yep, we killed him in part three. Or we killed him in part four. And guess what? Part five, it was a different guy. And then we reanimated his body Frankenstein style. So you got him even more. At least they explained it. But, you know, to a certain extent, and you'll see not so much in this one, but in part five, Halloween 2, I think, is the most problematic of the films because it created a mythos behind him that we talked about in the last episode that made sequels almost impossible to make.
Right.
By interjecting this weird cult aspect that he's some type of pagan monster and stuff like that, and they were forced to deal with it, and this will finally come to a head in part six, which I finally watched the producer's cut of, and you can catch that on next week's episode. I don't hate the producer's cut of part six. I feel like they did the best that they could, and I kind of didn't hate it.
They tried to make it work with what they were given. They tried really hard.
But we'll get more into that as we progress into next week. Now, the plot for this one's pretty simple. Michael escapes during a patient transfer and goes out to go kill his next of kin. Young Danielle is caught up in her having nightmare. This is the other thing that bothers me. Danielle Harris, who plays Jamie, she has nightmares about this uncle she's never met in her life before. You understand? She just has constant nightmares.
Like, she has a psychic link.
But no, they don't establish that in part four. They establish that in part five, right? Like that.
I think it's implied, honestly.
Okay. All right.
It can be implied, but I don't think it serves a purpose for the audience.
The way I read part four is that, like, Lori died in a car crash, and she made sure to tell her young, under 9-year-old daughter that there is a man in a white mask. He looks exactly like this, and he's going to murder you one day. She ingrained that into her head, which I thought was very, very funny.
Well, good night.
Michael ends up plowing his way through cops and teenagers with ease. By the time they get to Act Two, they're all locked down within the sheriff's house, which is Kelly's dad. And another thing that bothers me about this movie is their reliance on the state troopers. All they're trying to do, by the way, they have two police officers in this house. They're locked down with shotguns, and they also give Brady a shotgun to defend this house. And they're like, we just got to call the state troopers. This is their job. I've never thought of, like, you know what, my local police can't handle this, I gotta get the stateies involved to save, like, that it's clearly on the docket and in their bylaws that if monsters attack the town, that's a state police problem.
Have you seen the police force didn't do squat in the first two? I could see that. I want to go outside of that, you know.
Well, can we get back to Jamie though for like 1 second, if you don't mind? I have to say one thing throughout mostly this movie, I wouldn't necessarily say it follows into the fifth, but like an overwhelming theme with poor Jamie, at least the first half of the movie, I have never in my wildest dreams ever been like, let's pick on another kid for having dead parents. The whole first half of the movie is like, oh, you know why you're lonely? Because your family's fucking dead. Fuck you, 9-year-old with a dead mom.
You dumb dead mom bitch.
and that's on top of having the boogeyman as your uncle, you know?
But that's what's funny. If I'm not mistaken, there's almost less picking on her. Not that everybody maybe knows that. But, like, there's less picking on her about having a psychotic killer uncle than it is like, Your mom's dead. Like, you suck. Like, it is bananas to me. I know that seems silly to, like, point that out after everything you go through, but it just, the fact that that is a motivator for her pain in this movie is crazy.
Yeah, it's like, why even survive if that's your reality? Like, we're rooting for Jamie to make it through this night so that she can go back to this childhood hell that is her everyday existence.
I was waiting for the next movie, like number 5, where they're like, oh my god, your whole town's dead. Loser.
Your uncle stabbed someone with a shotgun.
So during the lockdown, of course, Michael Myers is able to infiltrate. Dr. Loomis just leaves. He's like, I got to go look for Michael. He's probably going to this other place. He's completely fucking wrong. This is where you get the pretty cool gun shoved through Kelly scene. And he also kills Brady by, like, lifting him up by his face, which it's funny. Sasha Jensen actually mentioned that they're like, yeah, they always thought they, like, put a fucking prosthetic on his face when he's, like, digging his fingers in. But, that was all just fucking lighting that he held him up by his face like that, and they were like, yeah, that looks pretty cool. And he was just like, that's like the cheapest effect in this whole movie, was making it look like Michael Myers' fingers are getting jagged into his fucking face. So that's kind of
it's really saying something.
Yeah, so there's some cool movie making things that they actually did. They ultimately, Jamie escapes from all this after crawling across the rooftop and getting down, and runs into Dr. Loomis, who, I love Loomis's idea, he's just like, we gotta go into this school because the alarm will go off and that'll alert the state police, because the state police, anytime a school alarm goes off, that's when they come. There's a slight confrontation with Michael Myers in the school where old man Loomis gets thrown through a glass door, which just doesn't seem to affect him very much. He's such
picture the original Michael Myers throwing people so much, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's odd that he hasn't killed Dr. Loomis like 3 times over. What I mean? There's just something about him. He's like, I can't kill my old doctor. Maybe he does have some feelings for him, you know? Who knows?
Well, actually, sorry, can I say one thing about just about Loomis? I did make a note to myself, again, something specific about this movie. Is it me, or are they not incredibly mean to Loomis throughout this movie? Like, I think this is the one, if I'm not mistaken, where he tries to get on the car with the teenagers, and they're like, yeah, come on, come run, and then they, like won't let him on the vehicle at, like, the beginning of the movie.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. This is the coolest town ever. No wonder Michael was killed. We should be on Michael's side. He's killing the residents of this town.
It's bananas. They should have called Halloween 4 Season of the Bitch. Like, this is wild.
I want to just see it recut, where they recut this movie so it looks like it's the movie Up, starring Donald Pleasance. Like, that's my dream cut of this film.
I mean, the biggest takeaway I get from Halloween 4 isn't, like, you know, stay away from the creeps in your neighborhood. It's like, you know what? Bullying is a real problem. Like, this is bananas.
Yeah, maybe
that's the subtext. Maybe we missed out on this sociopolitical message.
You're right.
ultimately, Jamie is rescued by some friendly local hillbillies who then rush Rachel and Billy rush Rachel and Jamie off to the state police. And as they're riding down, which is funny because, like, they're standing outside the school, and again, they were like, he's in there. Can you just take us there? He was just like, the hillbillies, this is the least hillbilly thing I've ever heard. He looks over, he's like, you're right, this is a state police problem. Again, I don't understand how these hillbillies with shotguns think that they also know that this is their jurisdiction.
Nothing says Chicago suburbs like Appalachian hunters.
Yes. So this then culminates in the exciting climax where they're driving down the street to the state police, and Michael takes out very silently but at the same time incredibly loudly two of the hillbillies on the back back tailgate, and then hops on top and then rips the guy's neck off who's driving, where you heard the special effects gentleman earlier talk about more blood, more blood. Rachel then starts driving, knocks him off of the top of the roof by slamming on the brakes, then runs him over. Jamie gets out and holds her sweet uncle's hand, where there's this little moment where you'll see soon enough, maybe there's a little transference of evil when he's like holding her hand right there. And then the state troopers finally show up and blast Michael Myers into fucking God's green earth, where he falls into an abandoned well and disappears with a bunch of boards on top of him. Ridiculous kind of ending, but I will say I do love the very end of this, and I'm sure you guys will give your takes. They go back to the house, and young Jamie, who's dressed up in a similar clown outfit that we saw her purchase earlier in the film, dons the original mask at the beginning of Halloween 1 and ends up stabbing her stepmother to death with a pair of scissors, and then Dr. Loomis, who's looking up the steps, looks at her and... And attempts to shoot young Jamie, but is apprehended by the sheriff so that he's unable to do that. And the cycle continues, which I thought is a pretty fucking cool ending. You know, you could either play it, you know, you could play the next sequel as, okay, Danielle Harris is now the new Michael Myers. It's a little freaky, you know, kid killer. And not to mention, Child's Play actually comes out this very same year, so having like a little munchkin that wants to murder you seems right in the vein and the time of things right here, right? Unfortunately, we wouldn't get that for Halloween 5, but what did you guys think overall of Halloween 4? We'll start with Mike. Mike, what do you got for Halloween 4?
I think it kind of sucks. I think it looks terrible. Like the lighting and everything looks, it couldn't be more of a late 80s slasher movie, you know, like they didn't even try with the atmosphere. The story was nothing. There's a few creepy moments. It's a little bit fun, like towards the end, like the chase on the roof and things like that. But overall, I don't get why people love this entry. I think it's pretty bad.
Okay, that's fair enough. Ashley, your takes on Halloween 4.
I mean, let me just say that, yes, the very end when Loomis is screaming no is, like, my favorite thing. It's, like, me on every date. I don't hate the movie. It's hard for me to really, if I'm being honest, have any strong opinions about any of them, because I feel like after number two, it's just, I know what I'm getting into when I see these films. So it's very hard to have like a very critiqued, very specific opinion. I just like people getting killed and I like big titties. That's my feeling.
There's some, for me, there's some things that I wish were better and I wish, there's things that could have been done better. Like they talk about this one being slightly gory. I don't find it particularly gory, and the gore that is in there, I don't find like really that over the top. I mean, the only real gory parts that you actually see is originally when he's breaking out, he sticks a thumb in that guy's forehead, which is kind of gnarly, but
this was a reshoot.
Yeah, which wasn't that gross or graphic, right? To me, it didn't really blow me away. It wasn't, you know, anything. It wasn't anything even nearly as gnarly as you saw even in the first Friday the 13th film. And then the only other kind of gnarly kill, which I would say is the only gore one, is where you see that guy's neck get ripped open. But other than that, it still kind of abides by those Halloween principles of like, and same things that like Toby Hooper did in Texas Chainsaw, where, man, that looks really gory, but you really don't see much of anything, right?
Right.
It's like, yeah, he shoves a fucking shotgun through Kelly in the movie, but you see him do the shove motion, and then you see it come out the back of the wall, all. There's no blood in that at all. He kills right. the other guy just by holding his face, and everybody else you kind of just see is already dead. So,
this movie almost could have been PG-13 if they cut a few things.
Yeah, I don't find it particularly gory. It's like you either got to jump all the way in and make it that, or just don't do it at all, right? So, but I did like at least where they as far as a story standpoint, I like where they took it, and I would have loved to see, you know, a Danielle Harris, you know, if not being the new killer in the next one, at least being the cool sadistic sidekick that you're like, uh-oh, I see something fucking scurrying around like this, and then you turn around like, oh, it's a giant guy, fuck you, blah blah blah, right? Like that, I think it would have been cool to see them matched up, because that's one
powerful
thing that,
dialogue.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that's kind of missing from the horror franchises, is that you know, you see your superheroes and stuff like that, but superheroes like Batman, he always gets a sidekick. We've never seen a super villain or a super monster like this really get a good sidekick outside of you know, Godzilla, who got Godzuki. You know, that's the only one I can even think of. It would have been, I would have liked to see a young Danielle Harris as the mini one, but
I mean, if you're not counting killer families, you mean?
Yeah, no, I think that's a different kind of
genre.
You know, I think that's a different kind of monster. You know, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, where everybody in the city is in on it. I think it's a little different. Well, it's not like it's. I mean, I would think of it if I were to remake Halloween 5. I have Danielle Harris, and she's also a silent killer, and they work in tandem to take down people and make cool, like, duo things, almost like how a Batman and Robin would take down the Penguin, right? Like, one's a distraction, one does this. It's a cool thing.
I think we've seen it, but I don't know if it actually would work quite the way your fantasy is. I mean, like, we've seen it on some level in a different way with Saw, where he essentially finds his protege in one of his victims and they kind of tag team together. And then we also, again, slightly different, maybe more of the family category, is we have like House of 1,000 Corpses, Devil's Rejects, all that. I think we've seen it before, but of course, yeah, it has like the family element, or, you know, with the Saw, it's a slightly different reasoning. I think in theory, it sounds like a cool idea, but I don't think you have a franchise on it. I think it's a standalone film with two killers.
Well, I guess I'm not going to get to
read it. What about Tiffany in Bride of Chucky? She was kind of a sidekick, right?
Yeah, you're right. Okay, well, my theory's been completely blown to bits. That Tiffany is really what that's I probably antithesis of what I was looking for right there. Yeah, that's it. So, anyway, with all
take
those
that, Eric, ego.
But with all that said, that we did not get that for Halloween 5, which is goddamn it. I can't tell you, as much as I enjoy Halloween 4 as a movie, Halloween 5 just right from the very beginning when this movie starts, it just has that real shitty straight to Cinemax feel the second it's like when it rolls the credits.
I disagree.
Oh, you like the intro to Halloween 5.
I mean, overall, the aesthetic of Halloween 5, I think, is far superior to Halloween 4. The look of it, the cinematography, everything.
I mean, okay, maybe some cinematic effects might be good. I think about just how the credits roll at the very beginning. It reminds me of Jason Goes to Hell, which just felt like this belongs on Cinemax and never should have been a theater release. It doesn't feel there's no cinematic feel to it. The other thing about Halloween 5 that really bothers me is they actually just try to the dopey cop duo in it bothers me. Like, never in the Halloween franchise was there like the doo 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 boop.
Oh my god.
Dude, oh god, I fucking hated that. There's nothing more I hated than that.
I literally made a note to myself about the I think it's mostly the music around the cops. The fact that they added like the soundtrack / like sound effects to go with these idiot cops blew my mind.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's
Here's a little bit of our good old friend Mustafa Akkad talking about the success of Halloween 4, which, by the way, audiences spoke. They loved Halloween 4 when it came out, at least from a box office standpoint. It fucking nailed it. And, you know, again, thinking about Friday the 13th series, they're like, okay, well, they've made eight movies in, you know, they made seven movies in the last 8 years. We need to hop back on the fucking money wagon and make our next one. Mm-hmm. So here's Mustafa Akkad talking about the success of 4 and the setup for 5.
The draw of the Michael Myers name in the title proved why audiences were returning. Halloween 4 was a huge box office hit, going straight to the top of the charts.
It was 2 weeks consecutive number one in the nation. There is less gore and loss of suspense.
This sudden success meant only one thing: another sequel.
So we get this other sequel, and but with the success of part 4 came a little element I wanted to get into. You're going to hear Kathleen Kidmont, who plays Kelly in part 4, as well as Danielle Harris, talking about some of the stalkers that they picked up from the success of Halloween 4.
I actually was stalked for a while. He was really pissed off and said he was going to find me. There was about 2 weeks when he was staying somewhere in Hollywood at the Hollywood Bungalows that were pretty uncomfortable. And I was actually sleeping with a gun underneath my bed.
I have a stalker. I do. He hasn't contacted me in a while, but I do. I think it stemmed from back in the beginning of my career, which would have been the Halloween movies. He hired a private investigator when I was 18 and found out my home address and drove with his father and his father's girlfriend from Houston, Texas, to my home and knocked on my front door with a 9mm and a sawed-off shotgun in the trunk.
Some people, their whole education is...
Well, mom was waiting in the car.
Yeah. Well, of course, you bring mom to do your best stalking. I mean, that's stalker number 101.
Yeah, we've learned that from Ace Ventura.
So, yeah, I mean...
Yeah, that's like your mom taking you to the mall or something. You grow out of that eventually. You go to the mall and you walk around yourself and you meet her afterward in the parking lot.
It has gotten so bad, though, that Danielle Harris is actually, she doesn't like to do horror cons and stuff like that because she's scared. It's like, I mean, these are public events. It's like, there's no way my stalker wouldn't know I'm here. He could just show up and stuff like that. So
that's
she's always very uneasy going to these kind of cons and stuff, and usually has to hire a security guard to come with her just for this very reason, which is, it's sad. Listen, if you like something, don't be Jeremy Woodworth is what we're getting at, more importantly, you know? Just don't. It's not necessary. But Mr. Akkad even agreed that the script for part 5 and the timing was a bit too much on such a short notice.
Halloween 5 was rushed into production before the script had been perfected. It debuted only a year later in the fall of 1989.
That's a mistake we made. I mean, we bid 4 because it was so successful. My God. All right, let's hit them with 5. Well, we competed with ourselves because by the time the 5 next year, 5 come out, Halloween 4 for TV, video, we competed with ourselves. There should be at least 2 years between one and another.
I think it was released too soon. And even for the diehard fans, I think it came along too quickly.
So even the producer himself agrees, not to mention the directing choice. They hired Dominic Otheron Girard, who had a very clear vision of what he wanted to do with Halloween 5 and the elements that had been brought into it. If you guys are familiar with Greg Nicotero, he's like the main special effects guy from The Walking Dead. Was also basically learned all of his arts and skills from Tom Savini, the man himself. He was actually the special effects and makeup for this movie. Here's a little bit of Greg Nicotero talking about Dominic Girard.
Mirroring the events of Halloween 2, the issue of explicit gore and violence was again a problem.
I believe at the time they were fighting an X rating because of the violence.
This time, however, it was the director, Dominique Othenin Girard, who wanted more blood, something opposed by Akkad.
Dominique had a very specific vision in mind of what he wanted. I remember one specific instance where we were talking about a specific effect. It was a cop that gets killed sitting in the car in front of one of the houses. And I remember saying, well, I think that you should do this, and the camera could do this, and then you'll reveal the dead guy. And he said, well, what do you know? You're the makeup effects guy.
Wow.
And a lot of pouring through like some of the bonus features and a lot of things, a lot of this audio I'm kind of grabbing is from this wonderful DVD that I picked up probably like 10 years ago. It's called 25 Years of Terror, the history of the Halloween franchise. And a lot of the actors and actresses, grips, sound effects people all said there was this tension on set with the director, who just was, it, for all intents and purposes, just sounded like a real piece of shit through this whole movie. But what we get in this movie that will eventually bring us to part six in our next episode, you get the sloppily kill off of the original heroine from the last one, Rachel. She gets killed in the first act by a pair of scissors. They add this cult element in there where there's a man with silver-toed boots that walks around and kind of is stalking Michael Myers in the background. So they add this cult element to it. There's a fucking horrible mute kid because Danielle can't talk. She's in an insane asylum who is now clearly psychically linked with Michael Myers. Michael Myers has no medical treatment for his gunshot wounds from the last one. He's just getting dirt rubbed in his fucking wounds by some guy who lives in the woods who's just keeping him alive and rubbing fucking pine cones into his wounds this entire time. Who's just like, oh, it's Halloween, time to wake up again. Murders his caretaker and then goes on the same damn killing spree as he did 1 year prior.
I know this is ironic, but how much do you want to bet that he's an anti-masker?
I moved out here so I didn't have to wear my mask, and I refused to put one on this hobo man I pulled out of the river.
Was he investigated at all for the Unabomber activities at that time? Because he should have been.
Yeah, we don't talk about the hero that he was, that Michael Myers actually killed the Unabomber in this. So, we are also introduced to Wendy Foxworth, who plays Tina Williams in this movie, who's now taking over the role as lead heroine. She is, God, just dumb as bricks in this movie.
Oh, my God. I can't, the worst final girl ever, maybe.
God, there can't be anything worse than her in this movie. It's just like every bad decision you could make. And you're like, oh, my best friend got killed. Well, I got to go to this Halloween party. Like, it's just,
she's such an airhead.
God, I fucking hate it so much. And it's funny how, like, in the other films, like, you know, the other films worked to a certain extent because I cared about the characters, right? Like, I cared about what happened to Lori to a certain extent. I cared about what happened to Jamie. I cared about what happened to Rachel to a certain extent in all these movies. When they all become faceless nothings, much like Michael Myers, I don't care what happens to them. And that's kind of what happens in this movie. Even Daniel Harris's character, who doesn't speak in this movie, I don't give a shit about. Like, I don't care about one character.
Like her during the chase through the in the house, in the when she goes in the laundry chute. That was pretty good.
Yeah.
Quickly, one other thing I really like about this movie, that no other movie has the balls to do, two Mikes. There is Michael Myers, and there's a character named Mike, and that is realism, my friend, because if you were Mike, you would know that you are never, ever the only Mike in the room.
Finally, a realism that's brought to the feature films.
That's fair. But I will say about Daniel Harris in this film, she is, for not having many speaking parts in this movie, I think she's adorable, and I find her heartbreaking, and I'm like sad for her sad, sweet face. I love her in this.
And we do get the old timer back for now his fourth installment, Mr. Dr. Loomis, Donald Pleasance, who reprises his role as basically Captain Ahab, still trying to kill this fucking Moby Dick monster and being completely unsuccessful in doing so. Michael immediately goes back to his old ways, as the best way to get a kid that you're psychically linked to is to start murdering all her friends. That's how you get her out of the safe place that she's in right now. They bring her out. I also like that Donald Pleasance also treats Daniel Harris's character like a piece of shit. She was just like, you know, you're connected to it. Just like makes her cry.
Yeah. And uses her as literal bait for Mike at the end.
Yes. Yes.
Bananas.
But eventually this all culminates at the original Myers house, where there is a showdown between Dr. Loomis and Dr. Loomis, Jamie, and Michael Myers. Jamie ultimately tries to comes face to face with her dear uncle and tries to plead with the remaining humanity that he has left in him, but that is all gone. Dr. Loomis is eventually able to take down Michael Myers with a little bit of tranquilizer and a good old 2x4 like he's Hacksaw Jim Duggan, but just as he's about to finally beat the monster to death, he has a fucking stroke. So we're just left with Michael Myers being apprehended by the state police once again, but in the weirdest ending of any of the Halloween films, the man with the silver-toed boots comes in like he's John Wick, two submachine guns, blasts the cops, and frees Michael Myers, leaving us with the ending to Halloween 5 of a Daniel Harris just screaming in terror at the end. It's just, what a bizarre movie that was rushed out into production.
Well, so you know what's weird to me? I don't know if you guys, made this connection slash you had the same thought. That shadowy booted figure, does he not kind of remind you of the weird dude? I forget what part it is of Friday the 13th.
Part 9, yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Doesn't it feel like the same?
It does feel like that Jason Goes to Hell character who...
Duke,
yes.
Yes!
Duke. It does have a very similar feel, but in that one, Duke is actually trying to murder murder Jason, when this is a helpful cult member who we'll learn more about in the next installment, which doesn't come for another, 6 years after this?
Yeah.
So,
But I'm saying that's a huge opportunity loss, where they almost could have done their crossover to where he's like, I freed Michael because I'm gonna fucking kill him. I'm just saying, I think there was a lost opportunity for a crossover.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, it would have been a nice thing. Mr. Moran, what are your final thoughts on Halloween 5?
It sucks, but I don't think I. I don't seem to, I like I said, I don't think it's all that much worse than part 4. I don't seem to think it's, I don't have the disdain that other fans seem to have for it. I think, like I said, the cinematography is actually a little bit better than part 4. And those two movies are just not great films. They just feel like every late 80s slasher sequel. You know what I mean? This could have been Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3. This could have been Friday the 13th, Part 7. This could have been Nightmare 5. This could have been Big Mama's House 2. You know, it's just like...
Ashley, how about you? Your final thoughts on Halloween Part 5?
This one is definitely, unfortunately, going at the bottom of my barrel. I really found her companion kid super annoying. I just couldn't stand that little fucker.
Honestly, he'd be the worst thing if it wasn't for the two bumbling comic relief cops. Right. Other than
100%.
That kid saves, they belong in a special place in hell in my heart. But, I can only blame the kid so much. He's just a little kid. I can't, but God, I hate every time. He's like, where are you going? Why is there a deaf kid? Why is he in this movie?
And he's got sideburns, not to body shame. I'm you are 6 years old. Why do you have sideburns? But the kid's annoying. And even though I know part 6 is kind of a dumpster fire, Paul Rudd's in part 6, So number five gets my downvote.
All right, downvote from Miss Ashley. For me, I'd say part five, apart from Halloween Resurrection, which is goddamn a real bad movie, but honestly, oddly enough, still one of my favorite Busta Rhymes films, no matter how you cut it. It is the one though that I do like to throw on during the Halloween season where I don't feel like I need to watch any part of it. It's my favorite background noise Halloween film. Right. I will give it that. I do enjoy it. Just like this just sets the ambiance for how I'm feeling in the month of October. Yeah. So I do like that.
Both of these films, I feel like nothing happens in them. Like, how would you? Yeah. Like, at least Resurrection, you could describe like something to indicate that which one it is. These, it's just like Michael Myers kills people. That's pretty much it.
You're all right. But they are the building blocks for part six, which I'm starting to come around an underappreciated entry into the franchise.
It's gaining a cult following. It really is. In fact, I could not believe this at Books a Million in Harrisonburg, Virginia last week. They had on sale a Halloween Curse of Michael Myers T-shirt. I shit you not.
Nice. I will say that out of all the Halloweens, Halloween 6 is the first one I actually saw in the movie theater. So
lucky duck.
That was one I think it was one of like the first actual, unless you count Terminator 2 as a horror film, although I see it more as sci-fi action. I'd say the first real horror movie
Who sees Terminator 2 as a horror film, Eric?
I mean, there's some horror elements. It's
kind of October we put in Terminator 2 for our horror marathon.
It's a scary movie.
I'm with
Eric. That and Die Hard.
I think it's a little different than Die Hard. Come on, it has horror and spooky elements about it, but it's more. You're right. It's more of a sci-fi movie. So yeah, my first horror proper film that I ever saw in the movie theater was Halloween 6. And I got to be honest with you, when I saw it, I thought it was fucking great. And then as I got older, I didn't like it. But now since I've seen the producer's cut, I got to be honest with you, I love the producer's cut of this film that actually kind of explains and makes more sense of it and has more Donald Pleasance.
Yeah, it feels like a very loving tribute, like almost like an extended universe fan fiction type of thing, but done in a very, people who really love the franchise.
Yeah, and it was made with love, which I think I think is the best part of it, but we will get more into that next week. Yeah. Mike,
which was a terrible tagline for the film, though, made with love. That's not scary at all.
Yes. Mike, where can people find you at, brother?
Let's see, on Twitter, I am Mike Moran Wood, W-O-U-L-D. Confessional Podcast is everywhere. You can find Mike Moran Comedy on Facebook. I got a little YouTube channel going soon. And I'm on Instagram, too. I think I'm Mike_Moran_Comedy on Instagram.
Awesome, man. You got any cool shows coming up or anything like that? You want to I heard you have a new alt comedy thing that you're coming out with.
Yes, we will have a new room in Baltimore. This first one, we're going to launch it called Comedy Calamari. That will be on the 27th of November, featuring Alex Hooper from America's Got Talent be the headliner.
He
was on the America's Got Talent finals, and he insulted everybody, and of course he lost, but it was still wonderful.
I really do enjoy him. That guy wears tight pants, and he's got fucking balls, not just the kind that I can see through the fucking thing, but he goes hard. I like him. I like him a lot.
Absolutely.
So great. So check out all of Mike's shit so you can find all of that. Definitely check him out. He's a Baltimore darling, guys.
Thank you.
You can catch all things Eric Comedy at ericcomedy.com. It's Eric with a K, Comedy with a C. Second Saturday Shit Show is free every second Saturday of the month. That's hosted by Mr. Mike Quinlan and Kimberly Callahan, former hosts of the show. Ashley, tell us some stuff that you got coming up.
I have Brouhaha in Columbia, Maryland on October 14th. You can catch me on all social media at Ashley Pontius Laughs.
Ashley Pontius Laughs. Hey, and don't forget to check out the Quality Time Emporium. You can find links for it at ericcomedy.com. Get yourself a pogo gator. And because Jeremy's not here, I guess I'm going to take us out. Yeah, Halloween 4 and 5 are, yeah, they're pretty fucking
no!
bad.
No!
No! No!